You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nelson joins me fresh from his encounter with Mad Max 4. Hey there, Josh.
Good afternoon.
Filmology.com and on Twitter. It's spelt with a PH. Look, we'll jump into the film soon. First, though, the toe cutter from the initial early films has one of the key roles in the modern film. He and George Miller recorded this little promo. I just want to play it for you. It's delightful. It's essentially telling you to turn your damn phone off while you're watching the film. But you'll remember the toe cutter. I am the toe. Have a listen to this little promo clip they did.
Hey, it's me, your old buddy Toe Cutter. In the future, the world is a wasteland of sand and ash, all because the downfall of society was brought upon by the callousness of humans. Do yourself a f***ing favor and pretend to care. Turn off your cell phone and shut your face, or you might look into the night sky and see this swift hand of vengeance descending upon you, and you wouldn't like that, would you? Ha ha!
Cut. Good, Hugh. Good.
It's George Miller.
Just a little less scary, I think. Oh. A little less scary.
Have a lovely day.
What's his name, Josh?
Hugh Keysburn.
Hugh Keysburn. So he's the key baddie. Okay. People may know Tom Hardy, baddie in the Batman film, Charlize Theron, who's been in kind of everything. Quite a difficult film to describe. Give people an idea of what's going on, what it looks like, what it feels like.
Well, maybe I'll describe the tone or the style of the film first, because it feels, I mean, if you can imagine a cancerous Cirque du Soleil troupe on a two-hour car chase through a post-apocalyptic wasteland.
Yeah, very good.
Accompanied by a pounding rock soundtrack. Totally. And explosions.
Yep.
Aplenty.
Yep. Splendid, violent, awe-inspiring.
I'm still shaking. I think my adrenal glands have gone into overdrive. I mean, it is that. Yeah. It's a roller coaster ride. It's a theme park ride, and it's a wonderful cacophony of sound and fury, really.
But it works, doesn't it? Because number one, it's chaotic, but you always know what's going on. There's none of this complex superhero. Let's have story by committee and ram in all the plot lines we want in the sequel. And secondly, I don't know how many lines Tom Hardy and Charlize Theron have. They must have less than about 50 lines each. However, they're great. Like, they're really good. They're not acting a lot, but when they do act, it works really well. So there's good, solid acting, decent, simple story, spectacular stunts that don't appear too extraneous to plot, and quite sort of amazing.
Yeah, jaw-dropping. And in some ways, it's a return to that style of the first one. It's storytelling by bodies and machines speeding through a landscape, not, you know, copious amounts of exposition. I mean, we know everything we need to know within the first 5 minutes or 10 minutes of the film. We have Furiosa, played by a wonderful Charlize Theron. She is so good in this film.
Kicking butt, shaved head, prosthetic arm.
Yeah, she's missing an arm, and she's smuggling out this group of young girls who are basically the harem for the bad guy, played by Hugh Keysburn. And Mad Max gets almost sequestered into their kind of cross desert crusade to save the girls in the hope of finding the green land. You know, all these films are really about the promised land, or particularly from the second film onwards.
Yeah.
So this one is very much similar in that regard.
So why do you think it works? I mean, the story is not. I mean, I don't even know that. I mean, the central part of the plot really is Charlize Theron's trying to take these women away from the bad guy. So the plot is not really complicated at all. Yet it's remarkably satisfying, and not only because it's spectacular. Why? I mean, am I just a sucker for this because I like the old films, or is there something else going on?
For me, what works about this film, and it took me a little while to warm into the narrative itself, and I was waiting for, when are we going to get the breather? When are we going to get the downtime? And Miller's a smart enough director that he gives us the sparseness, the emotional moments, the time for the audience to catch their breath after one, you know, incredible set piece and before the next one kicks into gear. And I think it's a credit to the performances, particularly of Charlize Theron, who brings a real sense of emotional gravitas to her role in this. And she does so in the absence predominantly of any real dialogue. And, you know, I think it's, I mean, we've talked about gender on these shows before, but this has a really wonderful sort of political subtext here. I mean, it's women escaping a kind of a cancerous patriarchy in the hope of finding a matriarchal motherland. I mean, it's a wonderful narrative. And, you know, people who said you can't have radical politics in a high concept blockbuster, well, you've just been proved wrong.
In fact, Mad Max is almost the sidekick. And in fact, there's one key, or not key, but there's one moment where he becomes merely the prop for Charlize Theron to sort of do the thing normally that the hero would do. So that's kind of interesting as well.
Well, yeah, he's now taken on the role of the dog to Mad Max from the earlier films. You're right. He's the psychic. I mean, you're right. He's a hood ornament for the first 20 minutes of this film.
He's a hood ornament. a spectacular hood ornament. Look, what I want to do is, it's not easy to describe, but however, there are these, they call themselves something kamikazes, don't they?
I think that's a term, yeah.
Yeah, so there are these war boys. So there are these people who, I mean, they worship V8 engines to the point where they scar their bodies with pictures of engines, clearly because engines are more permanent than the human beings in this world. And they're called war boys. We haven't mentioned Nicholas Holt, who has a key role as one of these war boys. However, just want to play you a little bit of George Miller, the director, talking about these war boys and the sort of, you know, what he was thinking about how they should be.
These war boys have no choice. They're culturally impoverished. There's no books, there's no internet, there's no theatre, there's no radio, there's no music. All they have are the detritus of the past, and they refashion it. So a steering wheel becomes a religious artefact. They do the sign of the V8. The engine, they scarify it on their bodies because an engine is much more permanent than the human body. They chrome their teeth because chrome is such a rare thing.
That's George Miller giving you a really good description of the war boys. I want to bring into the conversation David Egbie. He was the director of photography on Mad Max in 1979. He's seen the new Mad Max, Fury Road, and he's also spoken to the man now doing his job on the fourth Mad Max film. David, thanks for coming in.
Oh, my pleasure.
What do you think of the new film?
Oh, blew me away. It's visually stunning and certainly a masterpiece in action. And it's amazing how far we've come in 37 years.
Yeah.
I thought it was a two-hour roller coaster ride with a couple of breathers, but it looks amazing. It just looks fantastic.
True to the spirit of the first one, do you think?
I think so. It's like the first Mad Max, where the Knight Rider and that action sequence where they're pursuing, but it doesn't stop. It keeps going, and the opening sequence in the original Mad Max was full on octane adrenaline, and this is that 100-fold.
Now, what I would love you two to do, you because you're a director of photography and Josh because he supposedly knows how to talk about film, it's very difficult to describe. They have these massive convoys of custom-made vehicles screaming across the wastes of the Namibian desert in Africa, and yet they somehow seem to weave it into a coherent and spectacular series of chases. I was actually interested, David. This is a major logistical feat, isn't it, just putting all of that together?
Look, it certainly is. Just even on controlled bitumen roads with one or two cars, and three or four people, it's a major logistics exercise. And Guy Norris and David Bird, Guy Norris is the second unit director and stunt coordinator on Fury Road, and David Bird was the second unit director of photography, just to put that together is a great feat in itself. And the thing is, look, they ended up doing it in Namibia because of the geographically and the locations weren't right when they went back to originally.
Didn't Broken Hill flowered?
Yeah, it flowered. It looked like The Sound of Music. They went back and it looked like the sound. You expect to see Julie Andrews running over the hill, but it was very lush and green. And in the premiere, the George Miller actually gave a little introductory speech and showed some photographs of the original location. And then when they went back, it was literally like The Sound of Music, green and lush with flowers. But just to, you know, just to sort of put that together, and this was, as I said, like Mad Max original one 100 times with huge trucks, and they probably wouldn't have been able to do it as well in Australia.
Why is that?
I think the restrictions of
Work-safe restrictions,
The safety restrictions, also I think the landscape. I've filmed it a lot in the Australian outback, and I think you'd find it hard to find that amount of open desolation that you could rip up, basically.
Yeah, it's quite extraordinary. I mean, you can see some of those wide shots. It's just these massive yellow wasteland.
Yeah, yeah, huge. And maybe some of that's enhanced. I'm not sure. It might be enhanced computer-wise later. Sure. I know some of the skies are replaced. But the thing about Mad Max Fury Road is a lot of it is obviously for real.
What did they say about the technical challenges?
Pretty demanding. You know, like you can imagine 135 days plus shooting in the deserts of Namibia. You know, they had a sort of a little, they built their own village and you know, it was pretty demanding and tiring and a hard shoot. And, you know, Charlize Theron talks about the hardest film she's ever worked on, physically demanding.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I read that quote in one of the interviews on the weekend. Josh, those stunts... you're right when you say Cirque du Soleil is sort of on, I don't know, is it on steroids with barbed wire, I guess. Describe a little bit of the people when they're sort of swinging in on these tall poles.
Oh, that is one of the most amazing set pieces in the film. When you have, I think they've even got a name. Everything has wonderful names in this film. But it feels like, I mean, that was my response. It feels like a Cirque du Soleil act where you have people almost pole vaulting in and out, inside and out of the interiors of the cars,
while
trying to kidnap other inhabitants
while
attacking. But I think what makes this film so remarkable and why I was caught up in the moment, unlike say Fast and Furious, the film we watched recently, was that what you just mentioned, it keeps it wide. We keep getting the context. We understand what's happening, whereas so much of action cinema now, maybe David, you can comment on this, is filmed in these tight close-ups and mid-shots where you have no real sense of continuity of what is actually taking place.
Yeah, look, I think George is a master at the Sergio Leone-esque sort of filmmaking.
It is like
a
Western.
Of the wide expanse and then the mega ultra close-ups and to use that. You know, George knows the psychology of filmmaking, and every film he's made, he's very smart with that, and that's his background, maybe. I'm not sure. But, you know, you talk about the swinging in on the poles. Well, Colin Gibson, that was the production designer. Now, who thought of the counterweight at the end of the poles? Did you notice our engine box?
Yeah, their engine box. It was fantastic.
You know, so what a great sort of brainwave that is. So how do we counteract them? Oh, we'll just use V8 engine blocks and so forth.
But, that's just extraordinary.
Look, the cars, it's like the motorbikes in the first one, which were part of the character of the film too. Obviously, you've got your stars of this movie, and I love the fact that Hugh Keith Byrne was back.
He's extraordinary.
He's amazing. You know, I had a little bit of trouble understanding some of his dialogue because of the face mask.
Well, that's exactly like Tom Hardy's role actually in the Batman film. Great mask, hard to understand what he's saying.
So I didn't understand half of what he said either. But the thing is, the cars are as much the star as the actors, and they look great. The costumes and the cinematography. John Searle was the director of photography.
Didn't he come out of retirement?
Semi-retirement. I think, as cinematographers, do we ever retire? You know, I sort of wonder if we ever do.
Yeah.
There's a wonderful ode to the cars that ate Paris in this film too, with the design of the cars.
I was thinking about that. They do look a lot like that, don't they? Look, Josh Nelson, that's the voice you just heard. We chat film every Friday with Josh. David Egby is with us as well. He's the director of photography on the original Mad Max in 1979. I want to go into a few of the... I got a few trivia questions to ask David about locations, which he hasn't been prepared for. But look, 1300-222-774. If you're a big fan of the original films, tell me why. I can imagine there are a lot of people listening who... It's quite a seminal moment, the first time you watch Mad Max. I'd love to know how much of an impact it had on you. 1300-222-774 is the phone number. Someone's asking, do we need to have seen the first three movies beforehand? I don't think so. However, I do want to ask you, Josh, you watched the trilogy this week, did you?
I did. I rewatched them all.
Right. Did that enhance the experience of the fourth? Did you see a lot of commonality?
It gives you a new perspective on the fact that I think what Miller does is almost reinvent the character and the scenario on it each time. I mean, they sort of pay their debt to the previous one and then try and carve out a different type of story. I mean, each of them are very nuanced in their own ways.
Yeah.
For me, the original Mad Max is still my desert island pick in terms
of... Is it?
I was telling David just previous that when I worked at Melbourne Uni, I was a student there, I would deliberately walk through the underground car park every day on the way to the Bellevue just because to experience the Mad Max garage. Yeah.
You're very, very funny. Look, 1300-222-774 is the phone number. Someone asked if Bruce Spence makes a cameo. No, but there is another well-known Australian actor who's just popped into my head.
John Howard?
Is that him who has the problem with his eyes? He gets shot. And who's that Australian actor?
I don't know that.
I've seen him in Police Rescue. I'll try and do an IMDb search when we have a traffic update. But look, love to know your Mad Max thoughts. Philip's called from Flemington. Philip, what did you want to say?
Hi. Look, I saw Mad Max 2 first.
Yes.
When I was a young teenager. And we were in the city. We'd come from the country. We were in the city. And my new uncle married into the family. My new uncle was going to take us to the movies, and the women went to see Chariots of Fire, and we were off to see something, which yes. I can't remember what it was. And after the women had left, this is my grandmother and my mother, after they left, he said, "All right, boys, you want to go and see Mad Max 2? And we just went, "Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah."
And then we were kind of, the place was packed. I think it was Burke Street, Russell Street. The place was packed, and when the body fell out of the cabin at the start, that was the most horrific scene of a movie I'd ever seen in my life. And so that kind of etched into me forevermore. And after that, I just loved the motorbikes and the speed and that sort of thing. And I ended up, you know, racing my motorbike around a lot of speed and stuff, trying to, you know, go fast. So, yeah, very influential.
Okay, fantastic, Philip. Thank you. And, yes, someone asking about Hugh Keysburn in the first Mad Max. Yes. He's, in fact, in that little clip we played where he warns you to turn off the phone, his death scene, which is actually one of the more violent scenes in the first Mad Max, is in that little clip that he and George Miller filmed.
Subliminal cut.
Yeah. Yeah. But this, I'd forgotten there's the shot of his eyes as he gets creamed by the truck. It's really quite a violent film, the first one. Still is. Back in 1976 and 77, David Egbie was the director of photography on Mad Max. Josh Nelson is with me talking film. There's a few more thoughts about the film, but let's go to Roy, who's called from Glen Roy. Roy, what did you want to say about the first one?
G'day, Raph. There was a terrific scene. It was on TV just a few weeks ago, and there's this terrific scene where all the bikies come to the country town to pick up the coffin that had Knight Rider in it. And one of the bikies does a big donut in the middle of town and then takes off down the street. But there's a dog barking at him and chasing. The dog's right beside him as he's doing the donut and then chases him down the street. And it's just a hilarious little scene because, like, that used to happen back then on your push bike or on your motorbike.
Yeah.
You'd have dogs chasing. It doesn't happen now because everyone keeps their dogs inside, you know.
It's so true, Roy. Do you remember that scene at all?
I do very well. It was at the township of Chilton, and when all the bikies turn up and they reverse their motorcycles into the main street, and that was after the gum chewer and the gum chewer's girlfriend, I think they were called, were thrown out of the store. And,
right. I need to
and
watch
Mud
again.
Guts and Kundalini.
Well, they have amazing names in this film too. I think the Vulvalina is the name of, I don't want to give away too much, but there's some real feminine themes going
Valkyrie
through that.
And
the Bullet Farmers.
Yes, there's some. I can't remember all the names, but I do. For some reason, I still remember them for the first one. And that dog and went after the donut was done for real by a guy, the dog was belonged to a guy called Terry Gibson who used to ride on his bike all the time. So
of course he did. Sure, there were lots of people riding bikes. Jared's called from Rover. What did you want to say, Jared?
G'day, Raph. I was just calling to say that I loved the first film that much that I ended up calling my own son Max.
Is he mad?
Yeah, exactly. Bit of a violent film to inspire the naming of a child.
Well, he hasn't seen it yet. He's only 10.
Okay.
But he wonders why I don't let him play with my Mad Max dolls that are still in the packets.
Yeah, that one day they'll be old enough to understand that, Jared. David, just a quick name check on the locations. Little River.
Werribee, around where the sewer farms are.
That's where
we did the high-speed, a lot of high-speed motorbike stuff where the goose crashed his motorbike. Mm-hmm. The Yuyangs, around the Yuyangs, Little River, Chilton, Aries Inlet.
Yep. And Aries Inlet, you mentioned that house.
The beach house on the left is just before you enter into sort of the Great Ocean Road, just after the township of Aries Inlet.
And it's the only one on the other side of the road.
I think at that point it is,
okay. And it's Josh, you looked it up?
Yeah, recently. I think it sold for $3 million a few years ago. And you can rent it out by the week, apparently, if you've got the cash. Yeah, something
fantastic.
Like that. Yeah.
Hello. Susan might have had a... Susan, what's your story with the original film?
Oh, hi. My almost claim to fame was I was an extra for a day at that house. Which was very interesting, but they didn't include that scene, and I've always wondered what happened to it.
Do you know what? My wife, who I've been married to for over 30-odd years, was also an extra on that day on the balcony and the beach scene, and it didn't end up in the film.
Oh, there you go. You were both cut. Bad
it could
luck,
have been
Susan.
my introduction to a whole different...
Could have been your sliding doors moment, Susan. Who knows? I wanted to ask you both. I had this real impression while watching the film. Firstly, I was just all in from the get-go. I was just boom. it feels like someone with incredible imagination and great discipline. Like he's got one vision and he's gone, right, I am doing just this. And particularly coming off the back of an Avengers film that was crammed with just about 1,000 ideas too many. Is that a good way of summing up the film?
Focusing is very hard, and like just to stick to your guns, and I think George, I haven't spoken to him about it, but he obviously just went in with one mindset and stuck to it. I recently saw The Avengers, the latest one, which is I thought was a fantastic film. It's a huge blockbuster, but it's so CGI orientated that it pushes reality, and I don't like CGI when it pushes reality beyond physics. Whereas Mad Max Fury Road is obviously nearly all real. Yeah. And the realism, you can't beat the realism.
No, it's extraordinary. Josh, how would you sum it up as a film?
We mentioned it earlier. It's a roller coaster ride. It's 2 hours. It's a 2-hour thrill ride. And I think it nails it. And if you get off a good thrill ride and you feel excited, relieved, and your heart is still pumping, and that's 2 hours in a cinema well spent, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. Look, everyone from A.O. Scott in the New York Times through to, I actually saw a local newspaper in New South Wales, a regional newspaper in New South Wales, it's getting generally positive reviews. It is called Mad Max Fury Road. It's kind of pretty much on sort of everywhere. David Egby was the director of photography for the original Mad Max, released in 1979. Thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Josh Nelson does film every Friday. Thank you, Josh.
Pleasure.
Josh is going to go and watch it on a bigger screen, this time in 3D, and I think I might do the same.